This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cameron Aslan, today we have two very special people. Well, they're always very special, aren't they? But these are particularly special. We have the return of, she was once with BFM, and she is Azura Rahman. Great to see you. And he is, he's been on a bit of culture before, but you'll know his voice. He's a sports commentator, and he is the head of Malaysia Football League Broadcasting. He's going to tell me what it is again. He is Des Corkill.
Yeah, general manager of Malaysia Football League. Very proud to be promoting the local leagues as well as the international sport. And very honoured to be on a bit of culture. People from my neck of the woods aren't referred to as cultural. So thank you for the compliment, Cam.
Oh, that's not true. So actually, you might be able to tell from his accent that Des is also a native of Liverpool. And behind him right now is the paraphernalia of a football club, his favourite football club, which is celebrating coming 11th in the English Premier League this year. Congratulations to you and Everton. And he's surrounded by Liverpool Football Club. Here. So the fact that he is from Liverpool will come in useful in a moment, because our three topics this week will be: topic number one is culture in port cities, with particular reference to Liverpool, the rise and fall of. Topic number two will be politicization of sport. And finally, topic number three is no personal growth for Azura Rahman during COVID-19. I think I got that right. So with topic number one, I've been reading a lot on pre-colonial maritime trade in Southeast Asia, and constantly coming up is the cultural melting pots of all the various port cities and the particular identities that they developed. So I really like to talk because we have Des, and two, because in celebration of the fact that Liverpool Football Club has won the Premier League after, I think it's like 70 years. Talk about the Malacca of the West, Liverpool, which was once the biggest port city of Britain, and reaching its heyday in the 1930s. It's been kind of population in steady decline ever since, but it's a city, I think, that even the people who've never been there, I've never been there, Azura, you've never been there. There are legions of football fans of Liverpool in this country who've never been there. But I think that it's a city that people have a sort of cultural awareness of, different from, say, Manchester, where you draw a blank. And partly because, obviously, you can't help but think of the world's greatest pop band ever, which would be Echo and the Bunnymen. Or Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. But obviously I'm talking about the Beatles. And with the Beatles, one of the legends with the Beatles was that it being a port city, that sailors would arrive in port and they would have records that they'd picked up from overseas, American blues records, etc. And they'd sell them in the shops and it'd be passed around in somewhere like Liverpool as opposed to in somewhere like Manchester or Sheffield or what have you. At the risk of Malaysian splaining Liverpool to Des Corkill, I want to ask you, Des, has anything I said rung a bell with you at all?
Yes, except I've got one slight issue with you calling it the rise and decline of Liverpool, because it's back on the rise again. You're quite right to say that there's a huge population exit from the early 70s. It reached as high as 750,000 at one stage. And then when I left Liverpool in 1982, my education finished there, and I left because our unemployment rates were massive for people of school leaving age. They were over 30% for kids of my age. So there was no genuine work. And there's been a steady population, a wave has gone from Liverpool. It's down to about 500,000 now, I believe. But it's regenerated itself as a city. The idea of it was a port, It is no longer, well, it is still a port, but it's a container port. And so you don't need the masses and masses of labourers and seamen that you used to require. But it has redeveloped itself. The waterfront now is a thing, a genuine beauty. It's used European funds. It's used government funds. It's redesigned itself. And it's certainly become a very attractive place to go to. So I agree with you that there was a massive decline and it reached its zenith or its worst in its nadir in 1982, 83, 84, when we had Marxist leadership of the community council. And then it's improved steadily since then. There was a, it became European City of Culture in 1988. There was a water park, and that happened in the 1984. Since then, it has improved, and it's a place that I'm very, very proud to call my home once again. Always proud to call it home, but particularly proud now because of its improvements.
But I've been talking about the culture, the sense of a culture. Azura, like I said, you and I, we've never been there.
Yeah.
But of the kind of those northern cities in a place called Britain that we kind of know the names of, but perhaps can't attach anything to, do you think you can attach something to a place like Liverpool more than anywhere else? Yeah, Azura?
Well, I lived in the UK for about 10 years, and I remember towards the tail end of that stay, there was a big build-up of about Liverpool being chosen as the cultural city of Europe in 2008. And there was a lot of debate as to whether, you know, it actually deserved that accolade, whether it was, you know, whether it was actually cool to begin with at that time, that point in time. But, you know, it made me kind of view that city in a different way. You know, you mentioned the Beatles, and of course you mentioned Liverpool FC. There were songs written about Liverpool as well that everyone knew about, like Ferry Cross the Mersey, that people just knew. But I myself had never ventured that far. Well, I've gone to the Lake District, but then never stopped by Liverpool at some point. I've been to Manchester as well for some reason. But it never crossed my mind to stop over in Liverpool, probably more as a fault of my own. But it's something that definitely was very much, had a strong presence culturally, even in London, in the sense that people who I met who were Scousers, they were very proud of their roots and, you know, made a point to make sure that people knew of their roots. So there's definitely a pride in being from that city that that came across people who were from there. So I think at that point, you know, it did make, you know, in 2008, when it was about to become the European City of Culture, it really kind of made people view it in a much more contemporary way, as opposed to viewing it from the lens of what it was in its past.
I want to get to the past, though, Des. Azura just mentioned Scousers. So you are, I guess, a Scouse person. And it's an accent as much as anything else. And the accent apparently is it's a mixture of Welsh, Irish, and actually Scandinavian. Phonetically, apparently, there are many accents in Britain. But phonetically, apparently, it's very different from all the others. What do you think that, because it was a port city, do you think that you were experiencing different people or a different outlook on the outside world from your near neighbours in, say, Manchester?
There's a genuine belief that Liverpool is a little bit different. It is a genuine melting pot. We had, even as when I was a kid, you were very aware that you had a big Chinese community. There's a big Jewish community. There's very much an Afro-Caribbean community of Liverpool 8 and Toxteth. And they were part of each other. Yes, there were ruckuses between the various communities, but it was perceived to be a melting pot. My background is there's a bit of Welsh in me. There's a bit of Irish in me. My father came from the Isle of Man. There's a big Scottish community in Liverpool. We regard ourselves largely as British rather than English. We call ourselves the capital of Ireland, Scotland and Wales, and we have a real distrust of those who come from south of Birmingham. In fact, even those from Birmingham is a little bit south. And the accents, if I really wanted to put the accents on, it's almost indecipherable to people to listen to. So it doesn't travel very well. Jamie Carragher's probably the one who's even he's calmed his accent down. That we regard ourselves as a little bit different, and a lot of it, the main roots come from the Irish depopulation of the 1850s following the potato famine, and with that they brought a lot of poverty, huge amount of poverty, and that contrasted with the wealth of the big city, because at one stage Liverpool was the world's largest port.
And I want to end with one last thing, which is, and I confirmed with this with you earlier, Des, in Liverpool people say la. Is this correct?
We do la. And it's a derivation from lad. All right, lad, how are you doing? And then that just became shortened to la. All right, la. So so when I came over to Kuala Lumpur and people started calling me la, I thought, isn't that friendly of them?
Yeah? You were wondering why people were speaking Scouse, were you?
Indeed. I thought, well, the Beatles have travelled, Liverpool have travelled, and so has la.
Okay, we're gonna move on now to, and one day Azura, perhaps.
One day, perhaps.
One day, perhaps.
More of a Southern Jesse myself, I have to say.
Really? That does surprise me. And we're going to move on now to topic number two, which is a topic which I know is very close to Des Corkill's heart, politicization of sports.
Firstly, as you're, make sure you get up to the north, because the best parts of Britain are in the north and in Wales, and get out of that scummy place called London. So there's the message. So let's get on to the politicization of sport. So being from Liverpool, sport is very much part of your upbringing, and sport is a wonderful thing. Team sports, especially for kids, it provides health and fitness, it provides teamwork, it provides a framework and an appreciation of the merits of others, because a goalkeeper is only as good as a center forward. You need a fullback, you need a defender, be it football or rugby or whatever the sport. All shapes and sizes can play, any ability levels, male, female. It's fun, it's healthy, it's a smile. Sport in its purest form is the most magnificent thing you can possibly get. And as you get older as a player, you take it a little bit more seriously. It gives you targets, incremental targets that you can improve. So you can improve yourself personally. You keep your fitness levels healthy. It helps your personal growth and your achievements. It gives social acceptance wherever you are. If you can play football well, you will be accepted if you're into a football team. And for those who really make a good standard, it's a real way to earn a living. And if you come out of poverty, it's a genuine way to earn a living. And so sport for me is just the most wonderful, socially cohesive idea that ever existed. And then for the sports clubs, for fans, it provides a local and a regional pride. When your team does well, when Malaysia do well, the country feels good. It's proven that economically, performances of successful sports teams improve because people are going to work with a smile on their face. They're happy, they're feeling good. Their team, their identity is doing well. So there's local and regional pride. It's a topic of discussion. It's a topic of entertainment. Sports has all these wonderful, wonderful qualities. But us being the human race, we know how to ruin that. And they kind of, so politics kicks into sport. And when it was, you can read about the Nazis, and the Nazis had the Berlin Olympics was to showcase how good Hitler was and the wonderfulness of the Aryan race. But that's distant. That's not interfering with my sport. And then the Mexico Olympics comes in and you have the Black Panther, the salute. And again, that's remote from me. But politics is beginning to worm its way into this wonderful ideal called sport. And then as the years go on, commercialization kicks in, which initially is a great idea. Kettering Tires was the first one, and Hitachi for Liverpool. So that's good. It brings a few bob into a club. But then you get the betting clubs coming in, and you get the big alcohol groups coming in. And at most sports, I think it's 14 out of the 20 Premier League teams are now supported by betting companies. That's not good. Then you've got the Emirates, and you've got the Etihad, and you've got soft power coming into sport. So I was very much part of United Arab Emirates trying to use sport as soft power. I used to work on the Victory Powerboat series, and that just spread the word nicely. And so sport was just being used as a, hey, we're not as bad as it seems. It's quite good. And then you're getting Qatar coming in, you're getting the Saudis coming in, you're getting beIN Sports, you're getting all this. It's not about the sport anymore. It's about the commercialization of it. It's about giving a false impression or giving a good impression of something that has nothing to do with you. And now what's really brought this home is like it or loathe it, every single player in the English Premier League knelt for Black Lives Matter the other day. And that has nothing to do with sport. And it was just the culmination of this has just been, it's been coming, it's commercially soft power, soft power, soft power, soft power, soft power. It's nothing to do with sport. Football's already got its kick out racism philosophy. It's had it for years. So it's already dealing with that. But now sport is political.
Well,
that takes away everything of the good about sport and what it's meant to do for personal growth, personal pride, and personal development.
I'm not sure if I agree with many of the points you've made there, but Azura, do you agree with, because I know you do like sports.
I mean, I grew up with sports. In my households, either the news is on or sports is on, and whether it's football or cricket or tennis, rugby, there's always something on. Golf, mainly, because of my parents. I understand how things may have been in the past when it comes to, you mentioned Black Panther during the Olympics, people doing their one-arm salute, and fist in the air, more like. But of course, you know, in more recent times, we've got Colin Kaepernick and the NFL, who knelt down before the national anthem in America, and how that has kind of trickled down to, you know, football leagues in the UK and all that. Just like how, you know, Des has mentioned how sport has managed to galvanize people together and, you know, make them feel good about an achievement that's completely outside of the boundaries of day-to-day transgressions, day-to-day aggressions, just based on something purely physical, and it's actually beautiful, and how that can galvanize people together. I think perhaps in where we are now, it can also have a galvanizing power of bringing people together about things that's beyond the field, you know? And I think if it can help carry a message of positivity, no matter how political it is, it also has to reflect our changing world. And rather than it just being insular, rather than it being completely separated from everything else that's beyond the football pitch, maybe, you know, everyone finds that in the world that we live in now, everything is kind of meshed and everything's kind of interconnected, and we can't separate our lives from what's happening out there as much as we want to focus on the purity of the actual physicality of sport.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that sport happens in a vacuum. The many of the players who are taking a knee, so many players in football, both American and soccer, are black, and they have life experiences from that. And I think that if they wish to express that, that's fine. I don't know. It would clash, though, if somebody wanted to stand up and do a Heil Hitler. Then I don't know quite how I would square my argument, you know.
So this happened, Cam. So the England national football team played Germany in 1936, and they had to do the Hitler sign. One player, they decided not to do it, which was fabulous. So
they didn't have to do it. The FA decided to go ahead and do it.
So there's an element of compulsion there, like there's an element of compulsion in what's going on at the moment. Doesn't matter what side of the fence you are, you're taking something that is nothing to do with sport and making the sports people the center of that. And that is the major issue I have with this.
Yeah, that's a good point. But you know, the thing is that, look, you mentioned the Olympics. Olympics are all based around the nation state, which all came into being through a historical happenstance. They're no more legitimate or real than anything else. And so once you put on the colors of Italy or Mongolia or wherever, you are already making or involved with a political statement.
No, what you're doing there, Cam, is you're saying, I'm proud to come from this particular place and I will do my best. So you have the opportunity to not represent that country. And that has happened on multiple occasions.
Yeah, but
we've had withdrawals, as we have in the Moscow Olympics. So what I'm saying is the sport in its purest form is being used, abused for non-sporting purposes.
No, but you can love your country. You can love your country, but disapprove of certain aspects of it, which impact you and your community personally. Racism, you know, if you want to make a point on that. I don't know. I would say, though, one thing that we need to move on, but I'm going to add one final thing. Your beloved football club, Liverpool, has a stand, the famous Kop End, named after Spion Kop, which was the site of a battle in the Boer War where many Liverpudlian soldiers died. It's celebrating a war where a great many Boers, tens of thousands, died in the first ever concentration camps. So how do you square that?
Well, I think you'll find it's not officially called the Kop. It's been called the Kop as a nickname since it was first developed in 1906, or maybe a couple of years after 1908. It was just a mound of hills, so they just nicknamed it the Kop. It's not officially called that in any way, shape or form.
Okay.
Therein lies a problem in that you can attribute something that's not actually a fact into common myth. And therein lies the problem. Many, many problems. So let's keep the sport pure, please. Okay. That's my appeal.
Yeah. Okay, so we must move on. But in a moment, we're going to return with a story of personal growth that will be moving, or maybe not, from Azura Rahman and us here at Bit of Culture BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Raslan, Des Corkill, and Azura Rahman. And now, Azura, personal growth in the age of COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a response to an article in the Washington Post, an op-ed really, about how the pandemic can actually inspire personal growth. And the basic premise of this article is that when a person encounters trauma directly caused by the pandemic, instead of totally collapsing onto yourself, they may instead reconstruct themselves and the world that they inhabit via positive changes. And this is called post-traumatic growth, which is the direct opposite of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder in that sense. So it's something positive that kind of arises out of a hardship. And as this trauma, this pandemic is being experienced on a global scale, it may actually lead to a collective version of post-traumatic growth in that sense. And it's a very positive way of looking at how one can actually move on, and rather than trying to return to what was normal, but construct what is a new normal in its truest sense, creating a new world which is supposed to be better for everyone to inhabit, whether it's Mother Nature, whether it's ourselves, whether it's our systems, and obviously lead to bigger positive changes. And this is all from you suffering from the trauma of COVID-19, whether it's from personal loss of someone that you love, whether you've been affected by the disease itself and are now actually experiencing the after effects of the disease, whether it's you losing your job or you're losing your home. So the question is, for someone like me, and I know this can sound incredibly whingy and incredibly privileged, for people who haven't suffered a direct trauma from COVID-19, you know, you're kind of just told to stay put, right? That's the whole concept of social distancing. Stay put, stay at home, basically not do better, not do more, not try to reap a profit if you're running a business. Just survive and ride out the rest of 2020. Now, about 3 months, 4 months in, after repeating this mantra to myself while homeschooling my children and, you know, making sure everyone is intact mentally and trying to just adjust to the huge changes that we are facing as a family. Also at the same time, you know, my father also has just been diagnosed with cancer. So, you know, is also trying to adjust to that and not being able to see him. There's a sense of, at the same time, of just staying static, you know, and staying put. And at the same time, stasis has kind of set in. And which makes me think that this prolonged state of stasis also leads to decay in some ways. I mean, if you're just kind of running in one spot for so long and, you know, for the rest of the year, then it's kind of negative growth, isn't it? And you're not actually having any growth as how you would from year to year. I think for most of us on a yearly basis, we do new projects, or we go somewhere new, we travel somewhere new, and we, you know, open up ourselves to new horizons, experiencing new things, meeting new people. In that sense, for those of us who are just staying home and just kind of trying to, you know, just survive the rest of the year, you're finding that your universe has become so much smaller, right? And at the same time, okay, where have I been for the past 6 months? Just exactly where I was before. So I'm just wondering whether you have experienced some of this sense of decay from just staying put, you know, and what's your feeling about this whole personal growth that can emerge from this pandemic?
Well, Des, you're a very active guy, normally. How about you?
So there was a sense of frustration, I think, for the first 2 or 3 weeks, saying, okay, when's this going to happen? When are we going to be able to do something? And thereafter, after the first, it was March the 18th it kicked in. Once we hit April, there was an April the 9th deadline. And when that April the 9th deadline came and went, I think the world split into two. Those who wanted to do something about it, and those who were just going to wait and wait and wait and wait and wait and wait. My response was to just try and get out there and do something, even if it was unpaid. I think economically, there's a big price that will still be paid at some stage, and that's not going to hit us now. That's going to hit us at a later stage. But I made sure I kept myself busy in the broadcast world, in the sporting world. I took on a couple of initiatives, but that was a very conscious decision. So there's either the get up and get off your butt and do something about it, or there's let's just wait and see. And that's just a mindset, I think. And I hope as you strike me as somebody who wouldn't just sit on your butt and wait for things. You strike me as somebody who probably, had a wonderful time getting closer to your kids, giving them the most sensational education that they can possibly have as a young person, this kind of close contact. And if you're regarding that as a waste, I'm thinking, Azura, it's not. That's probably the most precious thing you can give to your kids, surely, because you've done something positive and they will benefit from that in the short run and the long run.
Yeah, I'd want to ask the same thing, Azura.
Through the screen, Des, in that sense, right? Only we can hug each other through the screen. I completely hear you, Des, but, you know, it's just, I guess in some ways, it's the remembrance of things past. You know, I had contributed to some magazines in the past year, but those magazines have now shut down. So that avenue of growth has kind of closed. And obviously no one is traveling at this point. So there's no discovering new places and new cultures kind of thing. Like I said, everything's just kind of a bit more domesticated. And yes, of course, I think I have done, I don't know, a tremendous job, but a job out of getting closer to my children and, you know, trying to educate them, teaching them things beyond the schoolroom kind of thing. But, you know, it's just, for me as Azura, I just feel like, you know, there's just been a sense of decay. And I think now that we are out of the MCO and, you know, we can venture a bit further than what used to be our front door, there's hopefully more opportunities. But I would like to think I'm not alone having this sense of decay, you know, who finds that not growing is an issue, because it's not just about surviving, I think, when it comes to you personally as a human being. But I think growing, I now realize as a person, is quite important to your sense of self too, rather than just, you know, being in that sense.
No, absolutely. I love it when Azura's on, because it's like a therapy session that just goes out to the world and she's just like completely, I'm going to tell you everything. I fall, I guess, somewhere between the two of you. I've always marveled at your get up and go, Des, and your like energy kind of thing. I, on the other hand, I don't think I've always hated myself when things were normal for my complete lack of personal growth and lack of achievement. So when MCO finally really kicked in, it was like, oh, wow, I don't need to do any personal growth and achievement. Pressure's off. I'm going to read a book. And I did. I read a whole bunch of books and I wrote about it. And I think it turned out to be, I think, one of the best things I've written. And that was just by chance, because the pressure was off. And I would absolutely agree with Des. I think that if you've spent that time with your kids, I never had that. I don't know about you, Des. I never had that with my mother, certainly not my father. He was dead a long time. But that's really pretty damn special. Unless, of course, you hate them. Unless you hate them, you know.
So one of the observations in my 20 years in Southeast Asia, 10 in Malaysia, is Malaysians and Singaporeans, we found, you love to self-flagellate. You never really embrace that, hey, what we're doing is really good. You're always looking somewhere else, or they do it better, or that's better, or why aren't we like them? You never look at yourself and go, hey, that was pretty useful. That's pretty special. And so without being big-headed about it, I think that once in a while, because Cam, you're a prolific writer. I love to read what you and your whole family do, and you've taught me an awful lot about Malaysian history and the parenthood that Azura is passing on. They're great things to celebrate. So yeah, it's different from the run of the mill that we had before, and it's certainly less lucrative in my case. And that is a real worry for me, not well personally, but generally how the economy is going to kick in the next 12, 15, 18 months or so. But pat yourselves on the back, those who are listening as well. If you've done something different, if you've lost weight, if you've learned how to walk up the stairs, if you've read books, if you've learned a skill, give yourself a big pat on the back and go out and celebrate and have a good tea tarek to say, well done.
Can you give yourself a pat on your back about anything, Azura? Could you put your finger on anything?
Well, you know, I guess surviving, that's what it is. It really, really is. I mean, it's from not having the kids with me for a good half of the day and being able to do my own thing. I think the fact that we're all talking to each other, and when I ask them, do they actually want to return to school, they actually prefer being at home. They like homeschooling, you know. It's I think that is an indication of some success on my part anyway. So I think it probably wouldn't come to me immediately, but I'm sure in reflection, 2 years, 3 years from now, when we look back at this period, we will see then all what we have achieved or managed to actually, I suppose, grow from during this period in one way or another.
Yeah, and if I do bump into your kids and they tell me that 2 and 2 is 5 and that the earth is flat, then, yeah, okay, then maybe we should. Maybe an intervention is in order. Okay, well, yeah, I mean, I think it's been something we've all had to face. And as Des points out, we're going to have to face it in a different way, and even more so in, say, 18 months' time when we discover the true economic cost of all of this. But we move on. We move on now to the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest. And I go first. I'm going to recommend something I should have recommended quite a while ago. It's a Twitter feed. It's at Southeast Asia Historian, actually, at SEA_historian. And it's an initiative started up by somebody unknown, Natusha Naidu. She has been getting different historians to curate this Twitter feed for a week. They've had archaeologists, people who do study cave paintings, maritime archaeologists, people from the British Library. It's a really good initiative. And actually, she invited me to curate for a week recently. My threads are available at SEA_historian. And it's a really great thing. I saw Des, I saw your likes. Azura, I did not see yours.
I'm off Twitter, actually, but I'll go back on just for your tweets. What did you tweet about? What was your contribution?
I was looking at a memory, how to remember the past in a place where nothing survives. If you go to Egypt, say, everything survives. Even like mummified cats, everything will survive because it's so dry. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, when you go to the museum, the things of the past were made of wood, and everything's gone. So what do we base our identities on, amongst other things? And also, I talked about port cities, actually. So that was why I wanted to talk to Des about Liverpool. So that's mine, at SEA_historian on Twitter. It's a great thing. Des, what have you got?
So mine is it's an old thing for me. I'm a passionate believer in local sport and what it can do. I came to Malaysia to work on Malaysian football because the passion that is generated by local sport is phenomenal. The Malaysia Cup finals are amongst the great sporting events in the world for an occasion. And the league has just been announced, will be starting again on August the 15th, unofficially. So I encourage people to, sadly, I've got to promote them to go on to Unify TV, but I encourage you to watch the local league because it's a good standard. And when they allow crowds back in, to get yourself down to your local stadium, to go and support Selangor, to go and support Perak, to go and support JD2, have got the most magnificent new stadium that they're not allowed to put any fans in at the moment. Or if you can't go to the stadiums to watch it on... It's on Unify TV, who are the main sponsor at the moment. But support your local people. Give your local teams a little bit of credit for what they're achieving. Because coming up in the start of September, there's two huge World Cup, Asia Cup qualifiers involving the Malaysian national team, where they go to the United Arab Emirates, where they take on UAE and Abu Dhabi, and then they entertain Vietnam. And if they win or get 4 points out of those two games, there's a very good chance Malaysia may well be strutting the stage at the Asian Cup. So we've got plenty in sport to celebrate here. And I encourage all Malaysians to get behind your local team.
Yep, Des may be from Liverpool, but his knowledge of Malaysian football in particular is absolutely encyclopedic. It's
he knows.
He surpasses mine and yours, Cam.
Yeah, yeah. Well, mine is really easy to surpass. So, okay, yeah. Well, so it's going to be behind closed doors.
Behind closed doors. We're still waiting the official announcements, but the but we understand behind closed doors for obvious reasons. But as and when crowds come in, that's where we really need you. We've got a league to finish, so there's 7 rounds of the league. Then there's the Malaysia Cup, and there's the international games to go on as well. Malaysia under-19s and under-16s are involved in tournaments as well between now and the end of the year. So it's a perfect opportunity to get onto the Malaysian sporting bandwagon.
Azura, what's your local team?
Selangor, of course, born and raised. Okay. My brother used to go for his matches every single weekend. When all the home matches, my brother used to go for. And my then boyfriend, now husband, used to go for all the home matches in Shah Alam as well. So definitely Selangor.
So get them down to watching the games again, Azura. Get them back into the stadium.
I know.
Okay. So Azura, what's your recommendation?
For me, this whole, well, we are no longer in MCO, but during the whole MCO period, anything that I used to watch would have a healing element, sort of cosseting sort of element. And one thing that I came across very happily is an anime called Your Name. I don't know if you've watched it before, Cam.
I've heard of it.
It is actually the highest grossing anime film ever in Japanese cinema history. It was released in 2016. And basically, it's a time-traveling, body-swapping tale between a high school girl and a high school boy, once based in rural fictional town called Itomori, and the boy is based in Tokyo. And it's about tradition, it's about dreams, it's about how people's lives are intertwined. It's so beautifully drawn out, so beautifully cinematographed. You know, it's really a joy to watch. And the soundtrack is really rousing at the same time. And if I'm allowed a spoiler, it ends on a happy note, which is very, very good for me anyway. So
that's important these days. I refuse to watch anything that doesn't have a happy ending.
Same here. You know, I've had friends who have recommended me very bleak zombie-style apocalypse kind of movies and series. I'm like, I'm having none of that. You know, yeah. I want to escape.
Those are for the good times.
Yes, exactly. We want joyful things. So Your Name is so joyful. It's available on iTunes. And so it's easily attainable. I mean, even the screenshots of it, every single frame is a picture. It's beautiful.
Good for all the family?
I would say PG-13.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I have no idea what my... my mental age is, so I don't know. I don't think I'm able to watch that.
You'd be fine. You'd be just about fine, Cam.
Okay. But I have to watch it with an adult. Okay.
Yes.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for that. And well, that brings us to the end of this week's show. And it now just remains me to thank honored guests. Des Corkill.
Absolute pleasure. It's always a privilege to be on A Bit of Culture, Cam. And lovely to meet you, Azura. I was fascinated by your stay-at-home stories.
And also, genuine congratulations to you, Des Hill. You didn't, of course, obviously put in a stroke of work in their achievement, but Liverpool Football Club won the English Premier League, and that's quite something.
Yes. Visually, he made it very clear for us, so visually it's all there.
He is surrounded by, he's got like the Liverpool teddy bear and everything there.
There is a story. I was born on the day Liverpool played Everton, and my dad had to give up a ticket, and he was a Liverpool fan, so I've been a Red ever since.
Oh, okay. Oh, and thank you to you, Azura Rahman.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's always a nice confessional moment when I come to A Bit of Culture.
It's fantastic.
A bit of confession.
It is. It's great. I love it. And good luck with the teaching of the kids as well. And
good luck to them.
Yeah, I hope you don't all go completely mad and stuff. And also, thank you from me, Cam Ruslan. And so please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.